This is Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Matt Hansen, founder and CEO of Simple Nexus. Matt's company makes it easier to share documents and communicate with loan officers when applying for a home mortgage. For most of us, buying a home is the largest single purchase we'll make in our lifetime. It's also big business. According to RealtyTrack, Americans took out almost 2 million new home loans in just the first quarter of 2016. On top of that, traditional banks are getting out of this industry. Prior to the financial crisis, big banks originated 75% of all U.S. residential loans. Today, that number has dropped to just around 50%. That's a huge shift and one that has benefited Simple Nexus. Join me this morning to hear how Matt took his company from a side project he pursued on nights and weekends to a firm that has grown revenues over 30% year over year since 2010, all the while without any capital from Matt nor from outside investors. Matt, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Thanks, Doug.
So your business is an app. The tool is an application. Tell us what it does.
Well, there are two sides to it, and I really like to think of it as a mobile portal for borrowers, all the way from searching for a home through the financing of their home, communication, transferring documents. It's also a mobile portal for the loan originators themselves so that they can be more efficient with their loan pipelines, so that they can do things remotely, whereas otherwise it's a more tedious process for them in their own lives. So we're really serving the loan officer and the borrower from a mobile perspective.
Is it often the case that the consumer has chosen their loan officer ahead of using your tool, and the loan officer says, hey, here's a tool that make both of our jobs easier?
Very, very often. So it varies. Sometimes the borrower finds out in an open house, and that's how they get introduced to the loan officer in the first place, through other distribution mechanisms we provide. And then sometimes it's that once they start the loan is when they start using the app. So there are different distribution points depending on how the loan officer would utilize it.
So I'm curious. You surprised me when you shared that it helps the consumer with the shopping and the discovery process of looking for a new home. Mm-hmm. Why is that an important part of your tool?
Well, loan officers aren't typically the first person that borrower goes to when they want to go get a home. They typically kind of get, and they kind of maybe do a little payment calculator online and kind of get an idea, and then they go find a real estate agent. Well, the real estate agents are great lead sources for the loan originators. So if they're able to provide resources for those agents to connect people with the loan originator, then it's a great opportunity for the loan originator, and they're willing to do what they can to get more of those leads coming in.
Okay, so that makes sense, really, as a way to strengthen the relationship between the loan officer and the real estate agent. Now, what about the flip side of that? It's been 10 years since I've purchased a house. We have lived where I live now for 10 years. But my sense is a lot of the realtors have a tool for the discovery process already, and in some ways that can be kind of competing with that realtor.
So the way we've structured it is it's actually 9 times out of 10 very complementary, because most realtor tools for searching for homes are a mobile website or something similar, and we can embed those within our product. So we really want our product to be a portal for everything that's going to happen throughout the process, and that realtor's home search tool can be embedded in the version that they're distributing.
So the core part of it, though, is really focusing on the loan officers and making that process of applying for, getting accepted, and ultimately getting your loan, making that whole process as smooth as possible. Tell us about the loan origination business. I mentioned in the open that the big banks are kind of getting out. It's becoming more of a game for independent originators. What's the state of the industry today?
Well, there's a big increase in lenders. Surprisingly, there's a big increase in brokers as well, who you know, a broker is typically going to, they're not going to do the initial financing in any way. They're going to involve another party who they think would be best to service the loan and get set up out of the gate. But yeah, we're seeing a fairly large increase in the number of lenders and brokers. We're also seeing consolidation. So we're seeing a lot of larger lenders buy out smaller lenders. And there are all kinds of requirements around that.
And how are those trends impacting your company?
Well, they're impacting us in a lot of ways in that we'll have a lot of loan originators around the industry who are using our product, and we'll white label a version for their company, and their company will get acquired by another company or a bank, and then the new company and bank will adopt the technology and roll it out there. So it's been great for us.
So if my research is right, your first customer was your brother-in-law.
Yep.
He was in the loan origination business. You mm-hmm. saw how inefficient that was. So you built a tool to help him with that. How about outside of your brother? How did talk to us about your first 50 customers. How did you get them on board? How did you get in front of them?
Yeah, well, so my brother-in-law, I mean this is back in, 2010 of December or something. And he just said, you know what? I want an app. I'm tired of people calling me and asking me to do a calculation if they put down an extra $1,000. I want them to be, just be able to do it on their own. And if you could put my face on it, that'd be nice. So I think, in a weekend I built that for him and gave it to him. And my mom's also an originator. And she said, well, I want one. So I built one for her, and then their coworkers wanted them. And it kind of kept growing from there, and I wasn't charging anybody. My wife just came to me and said, if you're not going to spend time with me, do you think maybe you should charge people? I thought that sounded reasonable. So that's how it started.
And so your customer was really people like your brother-in-law, not the consumer mm-hmm. that's shopping for the loan, but the loan officer. And how did you, the whole idea of pricing and thinking through that, this was a side project for you initially, but it's still an important decision. How did you go about thinking about the right pricing strategy?
Yeah, well, I think in the beginning, I almost think that there was a little bit of a confidence problem as far as pricing goes. I didn't necessarily think people should be paying for it. But it was adding real value. So I started out real cheap.
Why didn't you think people should pay for it?
Well, I don't know. I just like to build things. That was kind of my approach. I think it's fun. I think it's fun to build things and provide value, and that's how it started. But it turns out people were willing to pay more, and we've kept increasing from there. But when we started it, I think it was $6 a month.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest today is Matt Hansen, founder and CEO of Simple Nexus. Yeah, so the whole idea of pricing, you enjoy building things, you enjoy people using the things that you build. But as you mentioned, it was adding value, and $6 a month seems like an incredible deal. How has the pricing changed since then?
We charge $50 a month per loan originator now. And as we add more value into the product, that price goes up, but it seems like we're at a good point. With that, and that's a comfortable position for us right now.
And that's for as many clients as that loan officer
yep.
would have.
Yep.
And my sense is that's a really small part of their overall budget, and you're probably freeing up, I'm guessing, for somebody that has six clients, a dozen clients going at any one time, you're probably freeing up about an hour a day of their time.
Very, very likely, yeah. In some cases, much more, depending on how much they're utilizing the tool.
Now, you mentioned initially it was a fairly simple calculator
mm-hmm.
That clients could say, hey, what happens if I increase my down payments, and how does all that change? It's grown past then. In 2010, we were still sending physical documents back and forth and signing. I know the real estate industry, as well as the legal industry, has really led in this digital signature area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Does your app help with that as well?
In some sense, it does. There are limitations. When you've got investors who are buying loans, they still determine the rules on when they'll accept a digital signature or they want a wet signature. Although the law is good for a digital signature, a wet signature sometimes, I mean, if that's what it requires to sell your loan to the investor, then that's what you get. So in some cases, that's still what's required.
So you just said something that I think for a lot of our audience, they're not aware of, which is, you know, back in the day when my mom and dad got mortgages on their house, they went to the local bank. The local bank gave them a mortgage, and that local bank held that mortgage for 10, 15, 20 years until they paid it off. That's not how it works today. How does it work today? So somebody gets a loan. What happens to that loan?
It depends. If you go to a Wells Fargo, there's a very good chance they'll retain the loan. If you go to a mortgage company, who their business is mortgages exclusively, most likely they're going to sell it to a third party. If it's a smaller mortgage company, they're absolutely going to sell it. For example, a larger lender where they do exclusively mortgages, if they're going to service your loan, what they call it is where they would keep your loan. They've got to have several $100 million in the bank, required by law. So, it's not common for whoever you get your mortgage through, it's not common for them to keep it. They would sell it off to another bank or investor.
Well, you mentioned, if they're going to service it, they have to have a certain balance sheet. There's a lot of rules in this business. It's highly regulated. In a recent interview, you shared that the regulations was kind of played to your advantage. But I've got a quote here where you said, "We've already been shut down, fixed it, and came back." And that experience is what's helped you. What did you mean by getting shut down? Were you in several states and you had to pull your app for a while until you got in compliance with each state, or what happened there?
I'm trying to recall the specific quote. It may have been in reference to a particular compliance department with a company. We've been very aggressive in leading the industry in getting the proper security audits done, getting the penetration tests, vulnerability assessments, those types of things. The more regulated environment has been good for us because it's a barrier for competitors.
It also, I would guess, adds some complexity to the loan officer that you can just automate and say, hey, as long as we follow the process that's in this app, you know that you're compliant. Mm-hmm. Do those rules vary state by state, or are they a federal set of guidelines?
Most of the time, they're federal. You'll have a few exceptions, Texas, California, New York, but most of the time they're fairly standard.
Okay. Now, you mentioned a security audit, and that's a huge, huge thing. You're passing around very personal, very private information that people need to keep private. I know in 2015, there's the Association of CPAs. They have a trust services standard, and you guys passed that test, which is a very high benchmark. That was in 2015 that you passed that. How were you able to ensure security when it was just something that you were building initially for your brother-in-law and friends in the business?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's grown over time. A lot of my background has been in securing software. So I've been through these audits in other areas and understand what's required to meet the standards. Now we've passed level two of the audits, which means that the auditor comes in and is going to physically verify that you do what you say you do.
Yeah, it's a really challenging business because of it's highly regulated, as you pointed out. Security is incredibly important. And your price point is kind of capped because you're dealing with individual loan officers that oftentimes are entrepreneurs. They're working under the umbrella of a larger group, but they're probably paying for this out of their pocket. So they're price sensitive. And it's a tough space for you to carve out. But as I was doing research, I know before you started this, you also worked in another niche business that also seemed like a tough space for me. You built software for folks that ran motorcycles, RV, and boat dealerships.
Uh-huh.
That's almost by, you know, that's a classic example of a niche business. Mm-hmm. What did you take away from that experience that gave you comfort in the niche business space that the loan officer industry is?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I was working in a much larger company at that point. We were owned by a publicly traded company. So it was still very different, but I did get to go and, interact with a lot of the customers at that level. And, I mean, there's a great business in niche businesses, and it's worked out for us here.
Yeah, niche businesses, I think particularly for apps, can be a really interesting space, because as competitive as your space is, it would be even more competitive if there was 10x the number of loan officers that there are today. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more with Matt Hansen. He is the founder and CEO of Simple Nexus. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Matt Hansen, founder and CEO of Simple Nexus. So before break, we were talking about what you did before starting Simple Nexus. This started off as a side project for you. And while you were starting Simple Nexus, you were working for a company, if I've got this right, Simplifile. Uh-huh. Which is in kind of a sister industry. They were working with people in the title in the real estate industry. Was that company concerned at all that you were kind of in a tangential space that might be a natural expansion for them?
Well, I talked with the president and CEO there before making a move to this, and came to terms with him that he was completely fine with it and that there was no crossover.
It wasn't a slam dunk that it wouldn't be, right? I mean, your company's name is Simple Nexus.
Right.
His name is Simplifile.
Right, yep.
He's in the real estate industry. You're targeting a different group, but also in the real estate industry.
Yeah. Yeah, and the name, I mean, it happened to be something that, you know, I had a bunch of people vote on, and that's what was voted.
I like the word nexus. It has a good connotation. It means kind of a coming together, which very mm-hmm. much, you know, unfortunately, loans are very complex, and there's a lot of things that have to come together. So let's talk about your journey. Because I think how to get started as an entrepreneur, part of being a smart entrepreneur is minimizing the risk if the idea doesn't work out, right? I mean, it's a 70-80% chance that most ideas aren't going to work out. And so how do you minimize your personal downside? So I love the way that you started with this project. How tough of a decision was it for you as it started to grow beyond a side project? And I would imagine one of the first things that made it feel like it's getting bigger is when you hired your first employee. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that. At that point, it's like, okay, this is bigger than just a little thing on the side.
Well, it still felt like a little thing on the side. I was still working when I hired, working for Simplifile when I hired my first employee.
What did that employee do?
He was supposed to just provide support for customers.
People would call it two in the afternoon. They had a question on the app, and you're in your job, and
yeah,
you're putting your job at risk if you take
help
that
them.
Call.
That's right. That's right. And so I thought, well, I think that I can have this guy come in and manage this whole thing for me, and I'll just keep my job, and it'll all work out great. And it wasn't that easy. So it kept growing. And eventually I had to go to the CEO of Simplifile, and say, Paul, I have to make a choice on what I'm going to do here. I can't do both of these things. It's clear to me I can't do both. And at that point I decided to, pull the trigger and try Simple Nexus, full time. It was making enough revenue to support me and the other employee, without a major risk.
It makes it a lot easier, doesn't it?
It's a lot easier, yes.
What advice would you give a young entrepreneur that, you know, maybe has just gotten their MBA or just graduated with a consumer science degree. They know they want to be an entrepreneur eventually. Maybe it doesn't have to be today, but it's important to them. How would you help them think about when the right time might be for them?
Oh, gosh. I don't even know. I mean, for me, the biggest thing, at least that has been a big deal for me, is to, you know, learn everything that you can, but don't take what you learn as gospel. It doesn't work the same for everybody. So what the right time was for me is, it's difficult to say whether that'll have congruency with somebody else's situation. I mean, you learn everything that you can, and then you know, you listen to your gut too, and then you try and fact check it.
Yeah, I also do not think it's a coincidence that your company is in a space where you had friends and family that could help you understand the space, mm-hmm. as well yeah. as having worked several years for a company that was much larger that was in a related space. You knew a lot about this industry and the needs of the industry before you started your company.
I didn't know much. The title space, you know, a Simplifile is just, I mean, I basically dealt with recording documents to county recorders, which is very different from doing marketing for a loan officer.
Well, there goes my theory, because one of the things I tell young people is, you know, get some experience in a field mm-hmm. that you're interested in. Or at least learn from somebody, a team that's functioning well and is accomplishing things. So you can learn some practices. How do you set up a company? How do you set up a culture? How do you manage? Do all that on somebody else's dime, because those are all learned skills. Mm-hmm. And entrepreneurship is risky enough without having those skill sets.
I think in one sense, I was, there's a lot of good decisions, but there's a lot of luck involved too. And I started back in, you know, the end of 2010, which gave me a huge lead on competition, but companies and loan officers were wanting what I was doing. So they were willing to educate me on what they wanted. And I had time and was willing to listen.
Yeah. I noticed in a previous interview, this is probably 18 months ago. Your background's interesting on software development and how you got into that space. And in a little bit, I want to get to that. But right now, suffice it to say that you, at least 18 months ago, were still spending about half of your time doing development for the product. How do you think about balancing that?
So right now, I do less. I do less development now than I used to at that time. That being said, right now the way I approach things is I'm gonna keep 5 deals that we have as a company on my radar, and I'm gonna fill any role that's required to make those deals happen. That might be upgrading an existing customer. It might be acquiring a new customer. Sometimes our development, I mean, there's, you really only get so many distractions from development, right, before they get irritated with you. So there are times where I'm going to come in and I'm going to backfill because I want to get that deal done. And so it really comes down to, you know, what do I need to do to get those 5 most important deals done?
Interesting. So I misread the development side. I was thinking of it from a software standpoint. It's business. You meant business development.
Oh, no, I meant software.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So what features do these big clients want, these important clients want, in order to get them on board as customers? Is that?
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes it's something like, you know, they want an integration in with their appraisal management company, or they want the ability to interact with a credit vendor, or they want to, you know, integrate with something called DU. And there are just a variety of things that might be important to that company. Or maybe there's just something that they just need tweaked for them. These companies operate very, very differently from one another, if it's a great deal and we want to close it, then you do what you can to make it happen.
You know, I think 10 years ago, a lot of outside advisors would have cautioned you on spending too much time on the technical side. The reality is you're a technical company. Uh-huh. And you staying up with the trends and being able to continue to code is likely pretty important. I think Mark Zuckerberg has proven to the world that you can do that and other things. My understanding is Zuck is still a pretty good coder himself, and it's fairly frequently he's working on the code base.
Well, there's something unique that it does for me, and that is when I'm talking with a customer on the phone and I need to close a deal, I have a very good idea of what it's going to take technically to close that deal. Whereas a lot of time you've got a separate salesperson who doesn't really know, and they can't say at that moment, and they're going to check back in a week. And I have maybe the luxury to be able to make a commitment at that time because I have a very good idea what that
I would argue means. It's not a luxury. I would argue we are now at a point, and unfortunately, a lot of people in my generation have looked over this, but I think we're at a point now where being technically competent at some level is important for every job. I don't care which function it is. And I know you have an unusual background in coming to development. So let's switch gears and talk about this now. So you were not always the CEO of a tech company. You didn't always work on software development. You were an accountant for a period of time, decided you wanted to become a software developer, but had no background in that. Tell us how you went from an accountant to a software developer.
Yeah, well, before I was an accountant, I was a painter, which is what my family's done for generations. We paint houses and churches and whatever you can get, you know, your bid in on. Company that I worked for a while, I guess, just noticed that they felt comfortable with me and actually approached me and said, hey, look, we'll pay for your school if you'll come and do accounting for us. They just offered it. It was very kind, and I decided to take that up. And
painting houses is hard work. It's good money, but it's hard work.
I enjoy it actually, but it's I enjoy software a lot more. So I was doing accounting for them, and they're sending me to these classes to learn how to, you know, like click start buttons and stuff like that. And I took a programming class and found out I really liked it. So I kept taking classes and then I went to the owner of the company who also was part owner in a technology company and said, look, I think what I really want to do is I want to program. I don't enjoy accounting as much as I think maybe I thought I would. He was supportive, but didn't really influence that in any way. And so I went around and I found what I thought was the very best and most talented software company in the Valley. And I went to the owner and I begged him if I could come and work there. And he just, no. And I begged him for about 8 months.
And did you have a portfolio of projects at this point? Were you a fairly decent self-taught coder?
I was, no. I thought I could help out. But what it came down to is I went and worked for him for almost a year, worked for free, and had to promise to stay out of the way. And so I did that. I was working 80 hours a week for a year, and I sold used cars on the side to pay the bills. And then the dot-com crash happened, and everybody got laid off but me. It was really weird. I guess when you're working for free, you don't get laid off. But I ended up getting another job after that for, I don't know, like 10 bucks an hour, 9 bucks an hour or something, and programmed for a little while. And then finally I got a real programming job for an established company that was, you know, in incidentally the motorsports industry.
Interesting. You know, it's not surprising that you've been successful at Simple Nexus because of your tenacity. I mean, that's a very tenacious story. I think for a lot of folks that want to code professionally, the challenge is getting that first job and getting that first 18 months of work experience under your belt. Once you have that, there's more jobs available than there are people to fill them. But it's doing what you need to do to get over that first 18 months. But I would argue, regardless of that, I think everybody needs to know the basics of coding because we're in a technology world, and that's going to help you in ways that it is hard to identify when you start down that path. But I think it's a worthwhile endeavor for most people. We've only got time for a couple more questions. Another interesting thing about your company, unlike several of our guests that we've had on board here, you chose, at least in the early years, I don't know if you've changed tack on this, but to not take venture funding. You did not have to put in any of your own money out of pocket for this. The company cash flowed. And when you hired your first employee, the salaries, your salary, came out of the cash flows from the company. Have you still stayed on that tack where you haven't had professional investors?
We've not taken any investment money from any house. Well, that's not true. We got a $150,000 SBA loan, which is kind of a not really a big deal for us. I don't foresee us taking any other money in the near future. Our bigger problem is, you know, if we were to take more money, it wouldn't help us hire the right people faster necessarily. Maybe, but our bigger issue right now is how do we get the right people on the bus? And
that's my last question for you. Just the challenge of hiring the people that you need to hire to grow the company. How do you address that?
That's tough. I mean, you put your feelers out. I think you keep a bench of people before you need them, if you can. Some skill sets are easier to find than others. But personality and culture fit is a really, really big deal. We're constantly looking right now, you know, for developers and account reps and salespeople and, you know, looking for people who fit that role to kind of go to the next level.
Yeah, it's a challenge that every company has. And it's because of companies like yours that are growing, are providing opportunities. It's one of the reasons the unemployment rate in the state of Utah is one of the lowest in the country. We have a very entrepreneurial ecosystem here, CEOs like yourself that are providing great jobs for people. So we thank you for that. We wish you all the best going forward, and thank you for sharing your story with us today on The Bottom Line.
Thanks for having me on, Doug.
Our guest this morning has been Matt Hansen. He is the founder and CEO of Simple Nexus. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. You can hear our entire interview with Matt on our website, kcpw.org. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.